Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 20 years of experience as a law enforcement analyst, specializing in areas of organized crime and tactical analysis, has worked on high-profile police operations such as terrorism, murder, rape, and burglary. He currently works for the Devon and Cornwall Police in the UK. Yes, this is our first international guest on the show. Please welcome Steve French. Steve, how are we doing today?
I'm very well. Yourself?
Yeah, I am doing very well. How are things in the UK right now?
Things in the UK are kind of strange still. We're still working through this lockdown. We're still keeping our distance from each other. We're still working from our lounges and our bedrooms and our home offices. We're getting along though. We're doing well. We're doing okay.
Things have started to open up a little bit there, right? So you're just kind of going from lockdown situation to slowly being open. Is that correct?
Yeah, there was a bit of a sigh of relief in UK today because they've announced that the gyms and the sports centres and things can reopen. So we can all get off our couches and go and do some running and go and lift some weights and stuff like that. So everyone's a bit happy about that.
Hopefully things still progress there. I want to start going back in time to when you first started in law enforcement analysis and you were a analytical support officer with the Devon and Cornwall Police.
Yes.
Can you just talk a little bit about some of the projects that you worked, because they were more research influenced. So just talk a little bit about the projects that you worked on back then.
Yeah, I'll take you back a couple of years before that, actually. So in 1996, I was a student at Guildford University in Surrey in England. And I did a year's placement with the City of London Police, which is the police service which polices the square mile where all the financial institutions are, the Bank of England and Mansion House, where all the posh people sit. And I worked in their research department there, and I looked at quality of service. So it was my job to do customer satisfaction surveys with the police to look at how they felt their investigation was dealt with. So you'd ask them if they were happy or they were sad, if they had any comments to make, and how could the police improve on the satisfaction. A week after I graduated in 1998, I saw an advert for a job doing exactly the same thing in Devon and Cornwall in police headquarters in Exeter. So I applied for it and got the job. And I worked in this department, and my main role was in research. It was doing the satisfaction surveys for Devon and Cornwall, but also doing other surveys. So when they wanted a communication survey done, I worked on that. So looking at ways in which the police service could communicate better within its own environment, so its own staff. We designed a questionnaire which we left at the front desk of all police stations, asking members of the public what they thought of the police service, whether they thought their police station was open long enough hours. And what we tried to do there was to get some idea of how the police service could improve. And this is what the quality of service area was all about. It was all about making things better for the people of the communities of Devon and Cornwall, which is very much the tagline of Devon and Cornwall. It's serving all the communities, because I don't know if you know, the Devon and Cornwall is the largest geographic force in the UK. So it stretches from halfway down the UK right to the pointy end at the bottom, and then includes some of the islands off of the coast of England as well. So it's a huge geographic area. And so to make it tick perfectly, it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. And very slowly we saw that some of the things that the public were asking for, we managed to incorporate into everyday policing. So police stations stayed open a little bit longer, or they're open at weekends more, or they wanted more officers on the street in certain areas, because it turned out that vehicle crime was a problem in one or two areas. So it led to tactical decisions being made on the basis of these sort of long-term projects we were working on.
Was there anything else and maybe odd that people were asking about that you either did implement or you just couldn't implement? It was kind of maybe something a little bit more silly.
Well, there was a police station in Saltash, which I remembered always had the highest response rate for these surveys was from Salt Ash. Every single quarter of the year, we'd have like 150 responses from Salt Ash. And what it turned out that two people were going into Salt Ash police station every day and picking up one of these questionnaires, filling it in and sending it back in on the free post. So we were always getting really bizarre questions like the fish and chip shop in the town centre should be made to shut because their bins are always overflowing. There are too many dogs loose on the streets. There are too many cats on the streets, you know, things like that. So we used to get silly things like that. Sometimes people would be really angry because their crime hadn't been dealt with properly, or that they've been stopped for speeding in an area and they told us to go and catch proper criminals and things like that. So, you know, you can't please everybody. And very often people weren't very pleased because they thought they'd been singled out or targeted for doing things that they probably shouldn't have been doing, like speeding.
So is that still something that goes on today?
I think it's changed quite a lot now. I think that what they've done to that department, and I haven't worked in it for 20 years, so mm-hmm. I may be doing them a disjustice, but I think they've merged a lot of the services together. I think they probably still do a lot of the customer satisfaction, but I think it's probably done online now. I would have thought if you report a crime, you probably get a satisfaction service sent to you as to how well you were treated and things like that. And also we have a very sophisticated victim support service in the UK. So if you're a victim of crime, you automatically have the right to free victim support and victim care if you want it. You don't have to, you can opt out, but if you require it, it's one of those things that they're happy to provide. And it's very useful for some crimes. People find it invaluable. Other people choose not to. The crime is relatively minor. They don't tend to opt in, but if it's a serious crime, then they do.
So then you move on to be an intelligence analyst with the police. And just talk about some of the initial tasks that you were assigned to do.
Okay, so I became an analyst in 2000, and I was stationed in the Torbay area of the UK, which is kind of a suburb in Devon. It's a fairly large suburban area, but also has rural areas. In the infancy, back in 2000, analysts were new, and nobody really knew what to do with us. We were kind of put in an office and told to look at crime stats. And we were told to look at the hotspot, where they want to know where vehicle crime is happening and they want to know where violent crime is happening. And the answer to the question was, well, violent crime happens on a Friday and Saturday night between the hours of 10 o'clock and 2 in the morning, when the pubs and the nightclubs start kicking people out and they gather around the local kebab van or wherever and have a fight. So that's the hotspot area there. And then vehicle crime happens in car beauty spots up on in tourist areas. So the people go out onto the beach and they leave their handbags on display or their wallets in the glove box and criminals see them and take them. And we tell them this information. We're not telling us anything we don't already know. And we're like, well, that's because you're asking us stuff that's obvious. And so eventually the intelligence systems and the intelligence world kind of changed, and we got more embedded into investigations, and we got more embedded into actually trying to make a difference. Rather than telling people what they already knew, we were trying to make a difference to stop telling people what they already knew and add some value to the information that we were being asked to look at.
So what were some of the prevention strategies that you guys came up with?
So one of the things I remember looking at was an initiative. We have a large area. I say large. In the UK, it's large. In America, it would probably be a park. But it's a national park called Dartmoor, which has, and if you're fans of Sherlock Holmes, if you've read The Hounds of the Baskerville, this is where Hounds of the Baskerville is set. So it's Dartmoor, and it's 365 square miles. And it's the only place in the UK where you can guarantee to get all four seasons of the year of weather in one day. So you could get rain, you get snow, you get wind, you get sun, you can get anything you like up there. It has its own weather system. It has lots of car parks up on Dartmoor where people like to go for walks and stuff like that. So they would go up onto Dartmoor, and like I said before, they would leave their cars, and a lot of their stuff would be on display and cars would be broken into. And one of the initiatives we come up with was something called Moor Watch. So we managed to get our partner agencies, the Dartmoor Park Rangers and the local council as well, and we managed to get some cameras put into certain car parks. We managed to get a kind of a radio system going between a lot of the rangers and the police and the local neighbourhood teams. So when suspicious activity was seen in car parks, police or rangers could respond quite quickly. And in some respects, the rangers were given sort of limited powers to kind of enforce these cars to move on and things like that. So it had a really good impact. And those areas are still sometimes problematic, but signs went up saying, do not leave anything in your car. This is a crime hotspot. So please leave your car empty, leave your glove box open so people can see there's nothing inside it. Things like simple things that made a real difference in those areas. And we did see the crime rate in those areas, the car crime, decrease rapidly once we started this initiative. And it still goes on now in various formats. It's progressed an awful lot since I worked on it.
Yeah, so when I was at Cincinnati Police Department, we had a similar initiative. We told them to put their junk in the trunk, their cars.
That's a great way of doing it. Unfortunately, we don't have trunks, we have boots. So
you'd have to have something. Yeah, you'd have to come up with some nice little rhyme with boots. So I'm not sure it would work very well.
Yeah, I'll think of something for the end of this this recording, and I'll tell you what it should be.
Sounds good. But,
another one we had a lot of international students visiting the area who were always targeted for crime. They'd be robbed or mugged because they often have expensive cameras or money and things like that. So again, we worked with the local hotels. We worked with the schools that were housing these students, and we gave them again basic fundamental crime prevention. Direct them. We gave them packs when they arrived into the schools to say, don't walk around with your cameras on display in certain areas. Or don't walk alone at dark night time in the areas that you shouldn't be in, and things like that. And again, we see a crime decrease. But what we also managed to do there, for intelligence, we managed to get some profiles together of the main protagonists. So the people who were doing these crimes every year tend to be young lads aged between sort of 17 and 25. And again, I'm simplifying this, but we managed to specifically target these people, and you know there were pictures of around them in the wall around the police station, so people who knew who they were, they got targeted. So the police would stop them in the street and say, well, ask them what they're up to, and get everyday community intelligence and build up pictures around that way. And again, managed to both disrupt them and reduce the crime at the same time.
Both of the examples that you just used, it was the police in coordination with other departments in the city. Is that normally the way you guys would go about business? That's one of the main criticisms that we're hearing recently, is that the police are doing too much and not reaching out to other departments.
I think that's probably right. I think that there was a time in the UK where the police couldn't win. If they did too much, they got criticised for being too upfront. If they didn't do enough, they were too lazy. And I think that the partnership working model came in from, I think it came from London, from the Home Office or from the College of Policing, as it was back in the day. And I'm not an expert on this matter, but I'm fairly sure that partnership policing came in and it encouraged the police service to engage with like the health service, to look at the profiles of people who are coming into casualty on a Friday night with wounds, to record knife crime or knife injuries, to look at what we call nighttime economy, which is where crime around the town centres and public houses and things like that. So we started to engage with the health service and the local councils, the fire service to a certain extent. A network of these organisations was kind of set up, and it's carried on to this day. It's still really, really popular. Partnership working in the UK is big business, and it works because people get a better understanding of how each other works, and there's more data to share as well. But sometimes it feels like the police are the ones sharing the most and not getting much back. But I don't work in that field anymore, so it may be totally different now. But certainly at the time, it felt like we were always asking, and people were never giving.
Also sounds like the police there might be more open to letting data and research drive policy. Do you feel that's the case?
I think so. I think that's absolutely correct. I think there is a real call for data and research to change things. If we can show that if there's been an increase in knife crime, for example, and data can back that up, then it's a way to tackle that would be to engage with the people who are going to be dealing with it. So not just the police service, you've got a youth services intervention schemes, you've got the court system, you've got the justice system who can help as well. And by sharing that data and by producing research and also analysis into these matters and say that actually, you know, we do need to change these things. We do need to do some serious work around this particular area in this particular town because it's got a horrendous problem with youth gangs, for example. And again, I'm talking widely, and this isn't necessarily a problem where I work, but certainly in areas like London and Birmingham, I think that's exactly what's happening at the moment.
In the United States, different areas have different, what we call sunshine laws. Meaning what data is available to the general public.
Right.
And So in the UK, or at least your area, you know, you talked about information going to different research arms, maybe the universities or different companies. Is that in the UK, is it pretty open to get this kind of data to the public?
Yeah, I think so. The each police service and the Home Office have to publish crime stats on at least a yearly basis. It may be more regular than that. I'm not entirely sure. And that would tell the members of the public if they want to. It's all held online, so you can search. There's a crime map website where you can type in your postcode, and it'll tell you every crime, or give you data around every crime that's happened in your area in a certain time frame. It will say there's been 6 burglaries, there's been 12 assaults. Again, it's open to interpretation, and it's very prone to error, because if you get certain locations in a postcode, you're going to have a horrendous crime rate, and you may not have that. So, for example, if you share a postcode with, I don't know, a school, for example, you may have a higher crime rate than someone who doesn't share a postcode with a school, or you may have a lot of assaults in a certain area if there's a pub at the end of your road, those sort of things. So that information is very much in the public domain. And I think a lot of the other government organizations, such as the health service and the fire service and the sort of the public funded ones, are all in similar positions. So they have to produce performance indicators, and they have to respond to those. They have to tell the public how they're doing with those. Same with the train services in the UK. They have to meet 95% of trains have to run on time. It's that sort of stuff. So they have to show the public how they're doing, particularly if it's funded by the public as well. They have a right to know. That's why they do those sort of things, I think. So there is this drive for open government, I think they call it in the UK.
Then part of your time here was spent with antisocial behavior orders.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that and what exactly that is?
Well, I worked on the very first antisocial behavior order in our force era. So an antisocial behavior order is, if you have an offender, it could be anyone, it could be a young offender, it could be a serial offender who's always in trouble for criminal damage, public nuisance, drunkenness in the high street, those sorts of things. What the antisocial behavior orders did, and these have been changed an awful lot now, they're probably called something else now, but it was a contract set up between the police service and some partner agencies with that individual, to say, well, if you continue to be a nuisance, if you continue to be drunk in the high street or drink in a non-alcohol zone, you will be arrested and you can go to prison. And you get, it's kind of like 3 strikes and you're out, kind of loosely defines it. So the antisocial behavior, the one I worked on, the very first one, was this young lad. I think he was in his 20s, and he was a nuisance. He was an addict, but he'd been thrown out of his house, so he's living rough. But he was using a children's play park as to sleep in and stuff like that. And the public had just had enough of him, because he was always swearing in front of children. He was always drunk. He was always breaking things like this, or going into garages and stuff like that. So they did a lot of work around. We showed the number of crime logs he'd been involved in, which was something like 70 in a 2-month period. The number of crimes he'd been arrested for, which is, again, an awful lot. And things like that. And we put this package together and we presented it to the court, and the court said, agreed. And they served this order on this individual. And he, by and large, he kept to it. I think once his parents found out about this, they re-engaged with him. They brought him back into the house. He cleaned himself up quite a lot. And I understand now he's quite a healthy individual now, which is a good thing. And it got quite a lot of publicity at the time, this antisocial behaviour order, but it kind of has a negative impact sometimes, because sometimes they name these individuals and it makes them look like they're public enemy number one, and they're really not. It was designed, instead of just bringing this person into prison the whole time or into custody all the whole time, it's there to help them. Our agencies will engage with them and try and rehabilitate them in some way, or get them cleaned up if they're on drugs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can see that being deemed the problem child, so to speak, and the...
Yeah.
Emotional toll that can take on a child. And you mentioned getting them rehabilitated. Were there other programs involved in trying to get them cleaned up, get jobs, and other issues that they might have other than drug addiction?
I think it's more common now than it ever has been. There are drug test and treatment centres in various towns in Devon and Cornwall and across the UK, obviously, which will engage with police. Certainly the one I can think of locally, there are police officers embedded into this drug and testing centre who will know all the local people that they need to be involved with. And again, the same would work, I think, for alcohol dependency and things like that as well. There's an awful lot of service available for people who need help. mental health is a real big problem everywhere in the UK, and as I'm sure it is where you are. Our command team in our force are very, very strong on this matter. And they're saying mental health is not necessarily a criminal matter sometimes. Sometimes if somebody needs help, they shouldn't be put in a police cell. If they're having a mental health issue, they should be in a secure hospital or similar. I don't know the real phrases for it. Putting them in a police cell often is not the answer. Sometimes we find our custody centres are full up of people who have had mental health episodes when in reality they shouldn't be anywhere near a police centre. And that's what I think some of this engagement is about now, to make people's lives better rather than making them worse by arresting them and charging them with things that they really shouldn't be charged with.
So you eventually move on to the Force Intel Centre where you're currently working. Is that still part of the police, or is that what we might call a special task force? Or what exactly is that?
Okay. So the way that the intelligence structure works in Devon and Cornwall, the analyst structure works, is that we form part of the intelligence directorate, and the Force Intelligence Centre is part of that directorate. I'm actually contracted to Devon Intelligence Management Unit, the IMU, but we sit in the Force Intelligence Centre, you know, police headquarters. Just made that clear. And the intelligence directorate covers all the intelligence and all the research across the entire of Devon and Cornwall. That's two counties of the UK. And there are about 20 analysts and about 30 researchers, I think, in that pool. So, and that's where we work at the moment. Across, there are several kind of stations, and the Force Intelligence Centre is one of those stations, if you like. So it's not a task force. It's a department within, or a directorate within the police service itself. So we sit in crime department, and then the intel directorate sits in that umbrella.
So you use the word contract. Does that mean that you're not actually a government employee, but you're a private business employee?
No, I work for Devon. I'm contracted to Devon and Cornwall Police.
Okay, yeah. So you're still considered a government employee.
My ultimate wages come from the Commissioner of Police for Devon and Cornwall, I think, via various other resources. I don't look into too much, to be honest. Okay. I collect the check and I put it in the bank.
So you had opportunities to work outside the UK in this position. So you worked with the Bermuda Police Service and the Los Angeles Police Department doing gang analysis.
Yeah, the gang analysis thing was kind of strange because it was a couple of days. There was an analyst, and I think he's retired now, but I'll give him a name drop, Jason White. When I was in Los Angeles, he looked after me. I was at the Pasadena IACA conference, and I looked very lost. And he came up to me, and he put his arm around me and said, and he mentioned the film Hot Fuzz, which I've mentioned to you before. And he said, "Is it really like that, Hot Fuzz, in the UK? Is everything?" And I was like, "Yeah, totally. It's absolutely real. It's a documentary." and he took me around to his apartment. He drove me around Los Angeles. He took me to all these places which you read about. And because he was born in Compton in LA, and he took me to his house where he was born, and he knew absolutely everybody. It was one of the best days of my life. And he really showed me the real kind of Los Angeles. And he said, "Let's go meet some analysts." So we went to a police station. We worked, you know, as a kind of a team for a couple of days, working out which areas of Los Angeles were run by which gangs, and how we identified those gangs, and which streets were problem streets. And it was a really good experience, really good experience. And then I think the area was around MacArthur Park was the one area that we identified as being a real gang hotspot in Los Angeles. I don't know if it's still the same now, but certainly at the time, that was the area.
So let's get into your badge stories, because you have two of them. And the first one deals with rape, stabbing, and shooting. So if you would, please talk about that case and what the problem was and how you solved it.
Yeah, I'm going to do a slight warning that it does talk about rape, and it does talk about the gang rape of a female, and it's not particularly nice, and I make no apologies for that, really, but I just want to warn people about it. It's going to get quite deep and quite heavy, but fundamentally, this is an operation called Operation Maple. It was an investigation into the activities of a drug gang that arrived in the city of Exeter, which is one of the biggest cities in Devon and Cornwall, from Birmingham, which is a huge city in the middle of the UK, the second biggest city in the UK. And they'd set up what we know in the UK now as a county line. I don't know if you have county lines in the US. County lines are the term used by the UK police to describe the actions of drug gangs who arrive in a smaller city from a larger one. And they do this to expand their operations into smaller towns. So they bring with them a great threat of violence, and they use violence to drive out and put out of business local drug dealers. And they very often use gangs, children or vulnerable people to sell their drugs on their behalf. And they set up houses with vulnerable people. So they'll turn up at a house, knock on the door and say, we want to use your house to sell drugs, knowing these people are drug users. And they let them in. So we call that cuckooing, almost like where a cuckoo lay eggs. And the line bit of this relates to mobile phones. So in the UK, we call these graft phones, G-A-R-G-R-A-F-T, sorry. And grafts are the phones that they use to take the orders for the drugs. And these phones are their business, and they're really important to the lines. They can't work without their phone. In many of these drug gangs, the graft phone is held away from the city where they're actually supplying drugs. So there'll be almost like a chain of command, if you like. So in town A, you'll have this phone controlled by higher members of this gang. In town B, where the drugs are being supplied, you'll have smaller members of the gang, so sometimes children or youths, who are supplying, will take in orders on the phone. And then the dealer will contact everyone on the list, say, drugs are available. They'll send a message to the graft phone. The graft phone will then send a message to their dealer saying, five bags needed in the park. That's how it works. I'm massively simplifying that.
That's okay.
Because I don't want to go into too much detail on it because we haven't got a great bit of time on it. The gangs are often involved in other forms of criminality as well. So they'll bring with them human trafficking, modern day slavery, child exploitation, firearm supply. And this gang turned up in Exeter and they went by the name of China. And that's China with a Y as well, not China with an I. But okay. So they were called the China Crew. And this gang arrived and they tried to take over the local drug market. They did this by offering cheaper drugs and they started to increase the violence against already active gangs. This is where this incident or this operation got particularly vicious and particularly nasty. In the space of a few days, we had a firearm discharged at point blank range through a door of someone's house. Now, bearing in mind, I've been an analyst for 20 years now, and I've worked on two shootings in that time. And I can think of five at the top of my head of shootings in my force area in that time. And there may be more, but so any discharge of a firearm in my force is really serious business because we don't have guns in Devon and Cornwall, not really. We have a lot of intelligence about guns, but we don't actually ever see them. So to actually have a gun discharge was big news. Okay. So we had that. And then 2 days later or a few days later, we had a rival drug dealer was stabbed several times in a street. And then most concerned, we had this kidnapping and subsequent gang rape of a female in the Exeter. And this female was linked to this drug gang as well. So she was a drug dealer. She made no bones about that. She was a drug dealer, but she was taken, kidnapped and raped. Mm. So we set up the operation and I was attached as the analyst on the job. And the role we were given, the briefing by our superintendent at the time was very simple. Disrupt, dismantle and remand this gang, which is what we did. Eventually, but we had to catch them first. At this point, we didn't know who they were. We just knew they were called the China Crew. We knew there were three of them, and that's all we knew. And I need to talk about the victim, really, of this rape, because, like I said, she was a drug dealer for this gang, but what she went through was horrific. She endured a barbaric assault by these three men. They utterly humiliated her. They degraded her. They put a knife to her throat. They cut her hair with a machete. They made her drink out of the toilet. They made their shoes, all sorts of just a horrendous, barbaric experience for her.
That's awful.
Yeah, it was terrible. And when I read her witness statement and listened to some of her interview, everyone in the room who was listening at the time was very quiet and very still and very angry. We just wanted to see justice as soon as possible. I've never felt in an operation where everyone in the room was just like, okay, let's get these guys. It doesn't matter how long it takes. Doesn't matter what we have to do to find these people. Let's find them, get them off the street, and let's lock them up. There was a lot of anger. And her willingness to go into the detail about her attackers was crucial. And the actions that they took and the way that she described it was pivotal to their eventual jailing. And I know that's a bit of a spoiler. We did get them. I can't underestimate how important this lady was. She was able to describe these three men. She told us they were all Somalians. They'd arrived from Birmingham. She was able to tell us that they were boasting about having a gun and they shot up a house on an estate. They boasted about stabbing a rival drug dealer earlier that day. But what she didn't know were their names. She just knew them as China 1, China 2 and China 3. We were in the middle of this investigation with all this information, but what we didn't have was the crucial bit about who they were. But what we did have, which was good, was the graft mobile phone. We had the data on that. We didn't actually have the phone itself, but we had all the records of who were calling. and we were having regular updates on that phone on a kind of daily basis. So my job as the analyst was to analyze this phone data and other phones that were linked to the investigation, piece together the statements and try and work out the movements of the team and of the gang, which was relatively easy because where they were in Exeter has quite a lot of, has good mobile phone coverage. So we were able to show they were using certain phones, phone masks at certain times, and we could put them in certain locations. We had this phone was very busy. We were able to show they were drug dealing. They were sending out what we call bulk text messages. I don't know if you know what these are. It's where a phone will send out 100 text messages in the space of like 2 minutes. And it was basically a text message saying the same thing. And This is normally like drugs are on sale, come and get them sort of thing.
Okay.
So we managed to show that those text messages were sent at the same time as this poor lady was being raped. So somebody was sending the text messages while in another room in the house, this girl was being attacked. We managed to show that they were using two addresses by the phones. We managed to show that at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, for example, they were in one house and they were using a phone mask consistent with that. And then by 7 o'clock in the evening, they'd moved across the city to another location. And that tied in with what our victim is telling us. So we knew she was telling us the truth. I mean, there's no reason at all why she would lie. But she said she got into a car, they moved from one location, but she couldn't see where they were going. But we could show that this car and a phone went with it from one area of the city to another.
So real quick, Steve, how were you able to pinpoint that calls or the texts were coming from one particular house?
Well, the phone mask, the text message that was sent, there were 100 or so in the space of 2 minutes, and they all used the same phone mast location. And the cell attached to that phone mast was pointing directly at that house, and it never changed. So the phone was, fundamentally, the phone was on a table, and the person was sitting there just typing in the message and sending press send, and it went to all these people. So it was sent. We knew where the phone was, roughly, when that text message was sent, or those text messages were sent. We could pin it down to kind of like a 10-meter radius, something like that.
So even if you had houses that were close together, you could still narrow it down to maybe just a couple of houses.
Yeah. And we were quite lucky as well because we had CCTV. It was a flat behind a pub and the pub had CCTV and it showed this car turning up and it showed three men getting out and it showed the female with them as well. So we could back up what we thought when we got this CCTV about an hour or so later. So we kind of had everything we needed. So we could show them the gang moved from the rape scene to another part of the city. And then we showed through the calling circles of the phone that they were in contact with this other drug dealer. So, and this is the guy who got stabbed. So in effect, our rape victim's boss was phoned by them and some sort of arrangement was made. There was sort of two-way flow between the phones. So then one was calling the drug dealer was phoning back. And then our phone moved to the city centre and this guy, roughly where this guy was stabbed, the phone was there. And then this crew vanished. The next morning when we regrouped at sort of 7:30 in the morning, we looked at the phone data and they'd gone. The phone had left Exeter. It had gone to another part of the country altogether called Cardiff in Wales. So we just still didn't know who they were, but it would appear that this crew had a similar enterprise running in that area as well. What we did manage to do was put the phone inside a car as it moved out of the city centre. And then when that car came back to Devon, we stopped it and the crew were not inside it. They weren't there. But I mean, evidentially, we had loads. I carried out analysis for each offence and for the movement of the vehicles. We had CCTV, we had witness sightings, and we put all that into a series of sequence events timelines. And we spent a lot of time working on attributing phones. And by the end of the second day, we finally got two names. So we had two of the three names of these offenders. What we managed to do, and based on the descriptions that our victim gave us, we managed to say that we knew who China 1 was. And we knew who China 3 was. Now, China 1 was in charge, and China 3, we think, was his brother or cousin. We weren't quite sure, but they had the same surname. And we managed to show through phone attribution that the gang had been swapping IMEIs, so the handsets of the phones. We managed to trace one of those to a girlfriend of one of this gang. And through that, we managed to get an address in Cardiff, which was quite clever in terms of the phone had been registered, had been reused, and it had been subscribed. That handset being subscribed to this address in Cardiff, which was brilliant. We finally had an address. Our team, or the investigation team, decided to go to Wales. The intel cell, myself and a researcher called Rob, stayed in Devon to look at the phones and to keep, but we're on regular contact with them from the phone, but we wanted to keep that continuity. So Wales, where they were, is about 2 hours drive away from Exeter. And we had live phone data coming through on this phone, 20 minutes after the investigation left for Wales at like 9:30 in the morning, we had notification that the phone was moving from Cardiff back to Birmingham. And this is the bit that I'm most proud of, which is why I always choose this story to talk about. Mm-hmm. To get out of Wales and head to Birmingham, you have to cross a huge bridge. Now, I'm not allowed to say exactly where, but somewhere on that bridge, near the end of it or in the middle of it, there's something called an ANPR camera, automatic number plate readers. I'm sure you have those. You have those where you are? I'm sure you do.
Yeah, we have license plate readers here in the States.
Yeah, it's the same thing. So I called a favor to a colleague in a neighboring force and asked them to supply me with the details of every car that passed that camera between two set times, which they did. And they sent me the data and said, it's a huge file. There's 600 cars. And this was in 10 minutes. So you can see how busy this bridge was. Mm-hmm. 600 cars passed going in one direction in 10 minutes. And we thought, okay, that's a lot of cars. 3 hours later, the phone started to come back the other way. So it was traveling from Birmingham back to Wales. So I phoned the same guy and said, can I have the data going the other way? And he said, sure. Yeah, sure. 726 vehicles in a 15-minute period going the other way. I ran a duplicate value test in Excel, which is a really simple thing you can do in conditional formatting. You just put all your data into an Excel file. You click one button and ask it to highlight any values in the cells that are duplicates, which we did. So we had 1,300 different number plates on there. And we thought, okay, how many of those vehicles have gone from Wales to Birmingham and then from Birmingham to Wales in the time frames? We're thinking there'll probably be 20. It's a busy road, something like that. There was one. Oh. One car. out of 1,300.
Sometimes you luck out, right?
Exactly. And we're like, one car. And we did the necessary checks on that car and found out it was a taxi. And we ran the name of the taxi driver through our police national computer and found a conviction for drug use. And we're thinking, could it be that the China crew are paying this taxi driver in drugs to take them all over the place? And we did some work on our local cameras and we found that same taxi had been in Devon and Cornwall before our shooting. And this may have been the car that transported a number of offenders away from the scene. So we fed it back into the investigation and said, we think this is the car. We think, you know, it's a registered address in Cardiff, not the same address from the phones, but it's very, very close. And the guy has previous convictions for drugs. 20 minutes later, that car was stopped driving into Cardiff City Centre. And when they searched this car, two members of the China crew were inside it, China 1 and China 3, which was incredible. Just the sense of relief. We hadn't got all three. We got two of the three. And we were like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. But crucially in that car, they found a knife, a huge knife. And this knife mirrored exactly one that our victim had drawn on a piece of paper and said, they held a knife to my throat and it looked like this. And she drew this knife. Okay. And it had very distinctive holes in the blade and it was jagged and all sorts. And we took, for the evidence for the court case, we took a photograph of her drawing and we took a photograph of the knife that found and we put them in front of the jury and said, look, this is the same knife. And it was the same knife. So again, the strength of our victim, plus the analysis was great, because without that analysis that myself and my research had carried out that day, those two people would not have been caught. And they were arrested. And the next day, China 2 tried to board a ferry to the Republic of Ireland. So there's a ferry port at the top end of Wales, and you can get a ferry to Dublin from there. And he was found trying to board this ferry. And he too was arrested. So in the space of 24 hours, we had all three in custody.
Good.
Which was incredible. Then the investigation went to court and the details of these offenders came out. These three lads were all under 21 at the time of the offences. China 2, he raped our victim the day before his 18th birthday. And so this is how young they were. And our victim was in her late 20s. It was a nasty trial, really horrible. One of the worst I'd ever witnessed. They tried to make our rape victim, they implied heavily that she was a prostitute and she deserved everything she got. But she stood up and she was outstanding. She stood in the witness box and she fought for justice. And I think everyone believed her. I testified, or I gave evidence, and my phone data was not questioned. It was accepted as fact. They were all found guilty and jailed for, I think, China 1 and China 3 got 23 years and China 2 got 15 years. I'm really proud of the way that investigation went, the way that we worked as a team, the way that the analysis was crucial to the remanding of three very horrible, violent, nasty individuals who won't be troubling anyone anytime soon. it's something that I feel very strongly about. And I said to my researcher, when we finished listening to the witness statements and the video of the victim, and the choir are kind of dispersed, I said to my researcher, it's jobs like this that make me glad of the job I do. And I said, I would do this job for free. And I mean that sincerely. When there is such threat or such risk, or there's a child gone missing, or there's an incident which needs urgent attention, I'm proud to do the job I do. I get paid for it, but I would do it for free. I would do it for free if it meant...
I get your point, yes.
Yeah. If it meant that that child was recovered safely, or that person didn't get exploited, or that person didn't get stabbed, then, and I had to do it for free, I would definitely do it. I wouldn't hesitate. I feel very strongly about it. It's something that I think sometimes take things for granted.
Yeah, that's a great feeling. A couple of follow-up questions for you on this case.
Yeah, sorry, so I kind of babbled on a bit.
No, it's all great. You mentioned during the trial, that the trial portion of your story, that they were all under 21. In the States here, we might consider somebody that's under 18 to be a juvenile. The fact that they were all under 21, does that make them a juvenile in the UK?
No, it doesn't. If they're under 18, they're a juvenile. But I think there's a law passed that if they commit crime considered serious enough, it will go to an adult court and they'll be tried as an adult. Certainly that, he was 17 when it came to trial, he was 18, 19, so he was an adult, so it was an adult trial. The only reason I say they were under 21 is because they were so young. It was such a horrendous offence for lads that age to be committing. It was shocking, more than anything else. The judge didn't take into account their age. He didn't take into account the fact that they were young. He just said this was a serious offence. You committed serious harm to individuals, not just our poor victim, but also the victim who was stabbed. They could have killed people by putting the gun for the dog. Amazingly, no one was injured. You know, they could have caused loss of life. The judge said this is serious enough and gave him serious crime and punishments and jail sentences for it, which was good and the right decision.
What was the meaning behind the gang name China?
I don't know. A lot of these gangs turn up. At the moment, there are several gangs that are around in the area I'm working on, and they've all got names, and I have no idea what any of them mean or relate back to. You know, there must be seven or eight gangs in the last 10 years have all had the name ICE, or the street name Dollar, things like that. I don't know why they call what they do. When I was in Bermuda, strange enough, I met a guy who was a gang member, but had kind of broken away from the gang, was now working in his own bar on the beach. He went by the street name of Doofus. And I don't know why they called him that, but he certainly wasn't the stereotypical doofus. He was intelligent. And I think it's because he got caught once and the name kind of just stuck. And so it may be something to do with that. I don't know.
What drugs were the China group dealing?
So they were dealing crack cocaine, heroin, by and large, a little bit of cannabis, but mainly crack and heroin.
This particular case was very emotional, and you've worked on cases with terrorism, murder, and rape. What is your process to trying to deal with some of the stuff that is so horrific?
I'm not sure. We kind of have a debriefing system. We've got a very good employee scheme where if you need assistance, you need to talk to somebody about your crime, the crimes you've been working on, then you can do that. I think there's a 24-hour hotline. Things like it's very and the support network is through colleagues is quite good. Line managers have been very good. If you say to them that I'm a bit strung out of this job, I need a day to just collect my thoughts, that they understand. I think because to a certain point, up until very recently, I was managed by police officers who I think go through this process as much as anyone does, and they know and understand. And so do other analysts. I'm managed by analysts now, and I think they all would understand because they've all been in the same situation where if you say this job's really got to me, I just need some time, I just need some space, I don't think anyone's going to turn around and say you can't have that. And certainly with trials, if they're nasty, long, drawn-out trials, I've just finished a trial at the start of the year, which was, I think, 8 weeks, and I gave evidence four times in that trial, and at the end of it, I was drained, I was emotionally worn out. And so you just get burnout, and you just need some time to say, actually, I just need a day to go for a walk and just relax, or I go for a run. That's what I do. Other people do different things. But so the support is there if I need it. And I've, obviously my family are great as well. They understand, and I can talk to them. I can talk to my partner about it if she doesn't mind. And So it's great, you know. So and I think when you sign up to be in the police service and you sign up to be an intelligence analyst, you understand that sometimes you're going to see things and hear things that you're not going to agree with, you're not going to like, and they're going to shock you. And after 20 years, you do see a lot, but still every day or every operation, I'll see something, I'm thinking that's wrong. You know, sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's not, but you know, you get through it.
So let's talk about the biker feud case, because you have a second bad story that you wanted to share. And So let's get into that. What's the details behind that?
Well, I'll talk about it very quickly, because the biker feud was, and I always refer to this as, like Jason said, about the hot fuzz moment of my career. And what it was, in this sleepy town in Devon, a guy was, some bikers turned up and they tried to grab this guy and throw him in the back of the car and drive off. It was all to do with the fact that he had cheated or dumped a lady, and she wasn't very happy, and she arranged for this to happen to scare him. But that's the kind of the gist of the story. These bikers came down from another part of the country and tried to kidnap him. But unfortunately, it went wrong. What it was, towards the end of the incident, you had this guy running for his life, being chased by these bikers. And you think, well, that's pretty scary. But when you put the witnesses at the scene, they're saying, well, actually, what you had were these four really overweight guys, all in the age of 50, with beards and long hair and massive, what we call beer guts. and one of them had a leg brace, and they were trying to chase this other guy who himself was in his 50s, had a bit of a tummy, across the field. And it was described as being hilarious. They kept stopping to catch their breath, and they were shouting at each other, really, you know, cursing and saying, we're going to kill you and all this sort of stuff. But in effect, what had happened, they were just wearing themselves out. And then eventually they gave up. They couldn't catch him, so they went back to their car and got lost, because they'd never been to the area before. So they were just driving around aimlessly, not knowing where they were going. And what they also did was stuck very rigidly to the speed limit. So when they were trying to make their getaway up the motorway, the police just caught them up. and they tried to disguise the fact that they were anything to do with it. But in the back of their car, they had a full murder kit. They had blow torches, they had crowbars, they had knives, they had axes, they had rope, everything that you would imagine. And they were going to use this against this poor chap if they caught him. But lucky for him, they didn't catch him. For the time, it looked like a serious offence. But when you started kind of boiled down and when you looked at the data, it kind of was a lot of fuss about nothing, really. But they just took it very seriously. But they acted the part, but in reality, the delivery was terrible. I don't want to talk too much about it, because I think I'm going to possibly use that in any next conference. You've got a bit of an exclusive. But
oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
it's when I can show the in glorious Technicolor, I think that's what I'll need to do.
Very good. All right. Well, let's take a break.
Okay.
When we come back from break, I want to talk about the differences that the U.S. has with crime analysis versus intelligence analysis. I want to talk a little bit about how you got involved with IACA, IACA. And yep. I also want to talk about some of your personal interests, because you're a vegan and you're a runner. And so I want to get into some of that.
Okay.
So you're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Sean Bear, and I would like to suggest that everybody go learn programming. I think that's the one thing that has carried me through all the different aspects of my life. And if you learn some programming, you'll better understand the application that you use, and who knows, you might even be able to write your own application. Good luck.
Hi, this is Sally Rawlings, and I'm curious if other people have the same experience. You get on an airplane to travel somewhere, and the person sitting next to you says, oh, what do you do for a living? And you say crime analysis, and they go, oh, I love CSI. I watch all the shows. I almost did it, but then I didn't. So then you debate, do I correct him or do I just roll with it? I've gotten to the point now, I go, yep, CSI is awesome.
This is Steve Gottlieb saying, never let failure get to your heart and never let success go to your head. Always stay humble, because humility wears well.
Welcome back. Before the break, we were talking with Steve French, and he was giving us the perspective from the UK. And one of the things I wanted to talk about next is In the U.S., we seem to spend a lot of time and energy differentiating between crime analysis and intelligence analysis. And it seems to be just a phenomenon in the United States. And the rest of the world seems to lump them in as one entity. So I wanted to get your perspective on that, how you feel with the differentiation in the U.S. and just your general thoughts, considering you do have the intelligence analysis position, but you've done a lot of work with the IACA, IACA.
About crime analysis and intelligence analysis, I think the two fields go hand in hand. There was an analyst once who said, and I can't remember her name, Debbie somebody, you can't do intelligence analysis without crime data, and you can't have crime data without actual intelligence.
And that's Debbie Osborne.
Yeah, and that's 100% correct. You can't do that. So, and I think people think of intelligence analysis as this covert, sneaky, beaky stuff that gets gets on TV behind the scenes. You know, you've got probes and you've got all this kind of stuff. And while there is an element of that, the main difference between crime analysis and intelligence analysis is that intelligence analysis involves, in my opinion, the development of critical and substantive products that are centered on organized criminal activity. And crime analysis is often, but not always, less sensitive and is used more widely. But I think both fields are essential in the fight against crime. I don't know why there is a difference between the two. There shouldn't be.
So in the UK, do you have, you're in one big analytical group with multiple analysts. Are there analysts dedicated to more what you would describe as crime analysis and some that are more doing intelligence analysis, or is everybody basically doing something very similar?
In my department, they're all doing something very similar. So they're all operational intelligence analysts. But there are, we have problem solvers. We have kind of long-term planning analysts, things like that. So we have GIS analysts whose sole job is to put like maps and Reaper graphics and stuff like that. So there are different environments, if you like. But where I work, it's fundamentally intelligence analysis.
What are some of the other differences that you like to note between the US and the UK?
I'll tell you a story. When I arrived at the IACA conference in 2007 in Pasadena, the one thing that struck me, and I'd never experienced it in the UK, was the sense of profession. So here was an organization that was all about crime analysis. If you worked in the private industry, the police service, or any industry, you were a crime analyst, you belonged, and you remember, and that's that. And you looked after each other. There was people who would come up to you and say, "That bit of work you've done is fantastic. That your department or your organization or agency is doing amazing things, and we want to share and we want to progress." And there's a sense of like you could pick up the phone to any of these people and they would be willing to help you. And then you get involved in the IACA, the famed listserv that used to be, where people would call out for help on an Excel problem. And you could answer, you could put a question out, and within 20 minutes, you'd have 1,000 answers from people and all of them saying the same thing. So you knew it was right. And I never experienced that as an analyst in the UK back in 2007. There was a profession locally where I worked, you know, my department and all this sort of stuff, they looked after you. But I never felt across the UK that that existed. To a certain extent, it still doesn't really. We have a small organization called ACIA who kind of are trying to do what IACA or the other ones are trying to do. But it's very small scale. We don't hear anything from them very much. We get one email with a job advert on there or something like that. And that's it. There's never elections. There's never a progress. There's no training seminars. There's no books. There's nothing. So the one thing I think that the American analysts get right is IACA and the profession that has become a crime analysis from it. I think it's amazing. And I think IACA does a great job. And I don't think it sinks its praises anywhere near enough as it should do. Because it's great. And it's opened my eyes to a lot of things I never experienced before. It's opened my eyes to a lot of techniques and innovation that I've never seen. And some of the people who are doing their jobs out there are amazing. People like Christopher Bruce, who is just an oracle when it comes to crime analysis and when it comes to knowing things about certain things. He's incredible. And it's through that organization you can meet people like that and you can question them, you can talk to them, you can get to know them. And they've all got their little specialisms, and it's amazing. That much, I think, is the main difference between US and the UK in terms of crime analysis. We don't have a Christopher Bruce. That's the big thing.
there's no UK version of Christopher out there?
No. I mean, we had Jerry Radcliffe, but you took him off us as well.
So. Yeah. That was a special arrangement. So it's interesting that you say that. I think one of the aspects I think of when you were talking was analysis just came to be, it seems like. Just like how you said that you started to do analysis and they weren't really sure what you were supposed to be doing. They just wanted you to do analysis. In the States, that's exactly how it began. They said, okay, we were told that we need to have analysis. You're doing analysis, go. And I think in the States, we have so many different jurisdictions of law enforcement. There are, I want to say, about 20,000 different agencies, police agencies in the States, because it's a localized model. So they're all kind of in the same boat. They were just told to do analysis, but they were all separated out on all these different islands. Several people got together and started networking and reaching out to each other and sharing what they knew so that you didn't have to go through this constant process of recreating the wheel, going through it the hard way and learning it on your own. I mean, that's the model that IACA, IALEA, all these organizations have done. It's a networking, it's a teaching opportunity, it's a sharing opportunity, and it's amazing some of the stuff that you're able to learn and grow. It's funny because there's other aspects of the police department in the States where you don't see a lot of people reaching out outside of the department. It's so well established. It's almost like a silo. Like you're just saying right in the department, there's not a lot of reaching out. But analysis-wise, it was almost needed because you were just going to be constantly recreating the wheel if you didn't reach out and ask people, how are you doing this? Because I'm going to spend all my time trying to figure this out and not a lot of time doing analysis.
And that's kind of weird because analysis is supposed to be this introverted profession where we're very much closeted and keeping ourselves to ourselves, whereas the police service is more extrovert and you expect them to be reaching out and you expect them to make these networks. And it's weird how it's the other way around. It's strange. I do think the UK analysts, and I could be doing everyone a disservice here, and I'll put that bland apology in front of it now. I think we are quite introverted, and we are quite, in the UK, I think we are very much, some of us are in those bubbles, and there needs to be more reaching out and there needs to be more collaborative working between different agencies. It does happen. Don't get me wrong, it does happen, but I don't see very much of it. But maybe that's because I'm not looking hard enough, perhaps.
Yes. So, but you had mentioned that you're a runner. You had mentioned to me that your goal is to someday put on a race at the IACA conference, the IACA conference.
Yeah.
And just kind of talk about what your motivation is for that and maybe some of your goals.
I want to win a trophy. No. No, but I think people work very hard. I think we all do our jobs. We all go up well above what we should be doing sometimes. And we work hours and hours and hours. Sometimes there's not a lot of time for downtime or me time. And running is kind of my personal space, if you like. I love to, if I've had a stressful day, I'll grab the shoes and I'll go for a run. Where I live is a kind of a small village, and we've set up a little running group. Some of the dads from the local school, we got together, we get together on a Sunday morning and we run, we go for a kind of a 3-mile run. And it's really nice that you have this bonding going on now between us all. We all become quite close friends. You know, we talk about the world's problems and we help each other out. And it's a really nice feeling to meet someone at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning and go for a run. And I think at a conference, it'd be a lovely thing to do. It doesn't have to be anything formal. You could set up some sort of message system saying, no, I'm going to go for a run. It's going to be this long in length. Anyone wants to join me, meet up in the hotel reception and we'll go. And something as simple as that, I think it'd be lovely to have a Sunday morning run for anyone who's interested, whether you be Mo Farah or somebody else. You know, it'd be a good thing. It's a good way of networking. It's a good way of getting to know people. It's a great way to see a city that you've never been before. It's a great way of relaxing and getting yourself ready for the day. I think it'd be a really good thing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of races over here in the States will raise money for a certain cause. So
even better,
we could turn it into a more of an official race to where there's a registration fee or people can donate to a particular cause. Even if they're not wanting to be part of the race, they can still come out and cheer on the participants. So that's a great idea. I like that idea a lot.
I think it's a goer. I think it's a really good thing. I mean, I try, and I don't do as much as I should, but I try if I do go away for work or for anything else, I try and take a pair of running shoes with me, and it's a great way of seeing a new place. I mean, a few years back, I was down on the coast in Cornwall, and I took some running shoes, and I ran along this fantastic stretch of coastline that, you know, you wouldn't normally see, and it's just, you know, every now and again you can just stop and take it in. It's just incredible. It's a lovely feeling. Running's a really great thing, and it's good for you, and it's, well, relatively good for you. Sometimes you hurt your knees and stuff, but you know, it's relatively cheap. It's free. Once you've got a pair of shoes, you can go, anyone can run. You don't have to be good at it. It's the doing it that matters.
Now, you became a vegan recently. How did that come about?
Okay, so I've been a vegetarian for 30 years. So I've been a vegetarian when I was 14 and a half, I think it was. I'll just give my age away, haven't I? Sorry.
Yeah. You've done that already a couple of times.
I toyed with the idea of going vegan a few times. A lot of my friends are vegan. Some of them more militant and more vocal than others. And so 2018, New Year's Eve, I decided to go vegan. This is a couple of years ago. 2019, January the 1st, I woke up. I wandered to the kitchen. I put the kettle on. I made two cups of tea. I brought them back to the bed. They one to my partner, one to me, and she looked at me and said, "What happened to your vegan diet?" And I put milk in the tea and was drinking it happily. So in 2019, I turned vegan for 8 hours, and 7.5 of those hours I was asleep. So this year I thought I'd have another go. So January the 1st, I turned vegan, and I've now done about 6.5 months of without milk or dairy. Stuff like that. So, and it's going well. I don't miss it. I've introduced myself to loads of new food that I wouldn't have previously had. I've had some disgusting food. I had this food the other week, which was fish, but it was made out of tofu, and it was called toffish or something like that. And it was revolting. It made you think, well, actually, I'm never going to eat vegan food again. It was so disgusting. But
what's your favorite vegan dish?
I don't know. I'm a big fan of pasta. I think there's this superfood we call in the UK called quinoa. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you probably do get it over there. And
yes.
I love that. Anything to do with rice is fantastic. We've discovered things like bulgur wheat. You can make pretty good burgers out of those if you blend them with some Brazil nuts. It's incredible. there are so many different options out there that people just don't realize. And even if you eat meat, you can still do it. The plant-based revolution is probably going to happen soon.
Now, this stereotype for a vegan is you become, that's all you talk about. Like that topic of conversation just becomes who you are. Have you found that since becoming a vegan, that's a topic of conversation for you quite a lot?
I really hope I don't. It irritates me. And I don't want to get the vegan mafia onto me here, but it irritates me. Because there's a joke, isn't there? How do you know if someone's vegan? They'll tell you.
Yes.
And I hope I don't do that. Of course, you have to tell people, because if you're going around for something to eat and they're making, I don't know, something with cheese, and you have to tell them. But vegan cheese is disgusting, so I wouldn't try it. So I hope I don't say it, but I imagine everyone who's listening to this who knows me saying, yeah, you do. They're shouting, then yeah, you do.
Well, very good. Hey, so our last segment is Words to the World. This is your opportunity. I give the guest the last word, and you can talk about whatever you want to. You can promote any idea that you want to. So, Stephen, what are your words to the world?
I'm going to talk about coincidence, or the lack of coincidence. I don't believe in coincidences, and particularly as an analyst, I don't believe in coincidences. And I'll bring it into a work thing. The chances of two unconnected phones traveling from one place to another place at the same time is not a coincidence. It means they're traveling together. It meant to happen. And data doesn't lie. And if a data tells you that a car belonging to your main suspect and a phone belonging to his associate are in the same place at the same time, it's not a coincidence. It's a meet, and it meant to happen. My word to the world will be trust your data. It doesn't lie. And it can open doors.
Well, I tell everybody you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But Steve, thank you for being our very first international guest. This was a great time, and you be safe.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.